The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Maya Jolson, the founder and president of MetaPoint Advisors in San Francisco, you have an interesting theory here on ETFs that I wanted to discuss that is quite contrarian, which is why I am having you on the podcast. And the idea here is that we view ETFs as a very efficient way for investors, especially retail investors, to gain access to various asset classes, to stocks, bonds, commodities, long and short and leveraged. There's all kinds of things you can do with these ETFs nowadays. Your view here is a tiny bit, maybe not controversial, but maybe it is, but that these ETFs effectively don't work in that regard, especially the ones focused on fixed income. Mm-hmm. But then even some of the equity ones apparently maybe don't work quite as well, or if they do, are not as good of an idea as picking individual stocks. But I first want to talk about the efficiency of these ETFs as far as getting access to these asset classes.
Okay. Well, I think they're very widely available, and that's sometimes they've been created because they make money for the fund providers, the ETF providers, not necessarily that they make sense. So I think I might do a history of investing in the United States.
Okay, not too long because, I mean, if you want to go back to the founding of Wall Street, whenever
In the 1980s, okay. Basically, you had a pension, you would work at GM, you had a pension fund. They would have what was called defined benefit, and they would pay for your pension. Now, with Reagan coming in and people switching jobs, they started the 401k, where it's then defined contribution, which was then you yourself had your $10,000 and you had to invest it. Now, at that point, you had to buy lots of stocks. So you have to pay 100, you'd have to buy 100 shares. So you could only buy maybe one stock with your $10,000 because you had to buy 100 shares. So at that point, mutual funds came along and they said, why don't you buy a share and we as professional money managers will get you a portfolio and try to outperform the market. And so that was the rise of Fidelity and all the mutual fund companies. But what happened is, as we saw, a lot of them underperformed, which we can talk about why the mutual funds underperformed, and ETFs came along and said, look, they're underperforming. We can just replicate the market. That's within the S&P and the ETFs. And you can just buy us, buy this predefined set of stocks for much cheaper than a mutual fund and get at least the same return. And that was the rise of equity ETFs. Mm-hmm. So that made somewhat sense. What doesn't make sense to me, which is why I wrote a paper about bond ETFs, which was in the Wall Street Journal, to say it didn't work for bonds because people actually were getting much more risk than they realized. So traditionally, let's say you retire with $1 million at 65, they say bonds are a conservative way to invest. It's called fixed income. Right. So let's say you had $1 million. It was 2006. You bought $1 million worth of fixed income, U.S. Treasuries at 5%. They would give you $50,000 a year, add it to your Social Security. You're at $75,000 a year and you have very little risk. As long as the government didn't default, you had a legal, you have a legal contract that, that they have to pay you, or else, you know, you have a legal fight on your hands. The problem is we moved into bond ETFs, and people are going into them thinking that they have, it's a conservative asset class and they can't lose their money, but they lose all the protections they had when they were bought a bond, which was a legal document. So my point was, especially as interest rates went up, actually bonds lose their value. So let's say you originally had bond yielding 2%, you got 2,000 a year. The next bond that was issued by the US government was worth 3%, and therefore your bond would go down in value. Now, as the holder of that bond, you can at least wait until maturity to get your principal back. But if you're in a bond ETF, you have no, as interest rates go up, you were just going to lose money. So it made sense when interest rates were going down. But that's why I read as 2015, as interest rates were starting to go up, they didn't make any sense. And actually, clients were more likely to lose money on them than to make money. And that they needed to be aware of these risks, because what you thought of as a bond, bond ETFs was not providing that security.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And it's been the biggest story this week, pretty much, in financial markets, almost bigger in some places than the COVID-19 epidemic, was this implosion of the oil ETFs and oil futures. And specifically, the USO is one of the ones most widely cited. And this showed us firsthand just how problematic some of these ETFs are, because again, investors think they're getting access to an asset class, in this case, the price of oil. In actuality, they're getting access to the oil futures, but even there, probably not a very efficient way of doing it. And don't forget, these ETFs charge fees, right? Mm-hmm. Have you looked into the fee structure at all of like the bonds versus, you know, buying an ETF that tracks bonds versus buying the actual bonds at auction, and how those compare?
Well, it is actually cheaper to buy an ETF, but as I said, you're not getting the protection. The other thing you're not getting, so why bond ETFs don't make as much sense as an equity ETF, is a share of Coke, an equity share of Coke is a share of Coke is a share of Coke. That's not true with respect to the bonds. When were they issued? At what? Where is it in the capital structure? So one bond from Coke is not the same as another bond. So that's why actually, if you're going to go with you know, a bond, a fund of sorts, sometimes active makes more sense because they have an understanding of, hey, this, you know, we talked about, you know, back in the 2008 issue with the ratings agencies, this may have a AAA rate, but we all know that there are problems with this company and it's going to be downgraded. And so the actual bond fund managers know that, whereas the ETFs are just hungry vehicles. All this money is being autopiloted into ETFs via target date funds, via robo-advisors, by other advisors. So it's all this money going in, and they just are, it's a voracious funds that just need anything that kind of fits the criteria. So I say it can be the smart money passing the trash, the active bond manager saying, this is trash, but I know they'll take it because it has the right ratings. Bond funds are also problematic, even if they're active, because the problem, like we saw in the beginning of the year, is if people need to raise money, they might just sell their bond fund. Mm-hmm. Now, that bond, even though I might own this share bond fund, they have to share bonds within the bond ETF. And in selling them, they might have to pay, there might not be a buyer, and they might get terrible prices. And so that's why you don't want your bonds commingled with other people's, because you're losing those protections you have as an owner of a legal contract that you can get to, you can keep until maturity, and unless they go under, you're going to get your money back. So I'll put them in something called SMA, which separately managed accounts, so that they own the underlying bonds and they don't have to do a forced sell.
I was going to say, so for investors and maybe even retail investors who do want access to the bonds, to bond exposure, what options do they have?
Right. I mean, you can just buy bonds. The problem is they're so low yielding. What do we have? I think the U.S. Treasury about 0.6% or so. Right. We now even have problems within the municipals. But you can buy them. They're just low yielding. Mm-hmm. But that's why I'm saying for me, for my clients, I put them in what's called an SMA, which you do have to have. There are limit. There are minimums for that. But, if you're older, then that's something that you need to think about allocating your money to. But otherwise, I've started to look at a lot of alternatives because we're seeing that bonds are not providing that the return income that they traditionally did. So as I said, in 2006, it was 5%. Right. Well, it went down to 1%. You could actually, the U.S. Stock market was at 2% dividend yield. And that's why you saw this move, a rotation from bonds into stocks, which is why we had such huge valuations of the U.S. stock market before this 2020 crash, because of the relative yield of U.S. dividends to such low yields on the bonds.
Mm-hmm. Now, the low interest rates on, at least on the U.S. government bonds, that's going to be for primary, on the primary market. There is a secondary market too. Right, that people can access, where maybe you get some older issues that have a little bit better yield.
Yeah, they have a better yield, but then you buy them for a premium.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the deal. So you still have a very similarly low effective yield.
How long do you think before investors get wise to this, and what will be the cascading effects, if any?
That's a good question. I mean, I wrote I was worried about this, what I call a $5 trillion bond fund bubble back in 2017, was worried about it before, but we see now what's happening is the Fed's coming in, and instead of the market realizing, like, let's say back in 2008, mortgage-backed securities, it became well known that these were not AAA securities, and there was a reckoning. And now the thing is that the Fed's come in and has basically started buying up a lot of these both, corporate grade and investment grade ETFs. Mm-hmm. And so it's that reckoning is not happening.
Now, a lot of this stuff, I assume, would be in the disclosure statements that these ETFs provide, which, by the way, probably very few people read. I don't want to say nobody.
Right, exactly.
And then there's also leverage on top of a lot of this stuff. They'll say you have to look into the fine print to see if there's even any leverage in these ETFs. Is that something that people can do, maybe, is read through the disclosure to get smart?
I just don't advocate it. I advocate owning individual bonds, individual stocks, so you know what you own. And that's the issue too with ETFs, even equity ETFs. I say a lot of people have no idea what they own. I call mutual funds are expensive black holes. ETFs are cheap black holes, but they're still black holes. People have no idea what they own.
Right.
So I wrote an article about emerging market ETFs. People go around and talk about, the different parts of the world that are growing, whether it's Africa is growing at a much higher rate. Well, that's not really represented in the ETFs. So back in 2008, I worked for a major emerging markets investment bank. I advised Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan on investments in Russia, India, China, Brazil. It was the BRIC countries back in the 2000s. And now, if you look at the emerging market index, it's basically Asian tech stocks. 70% of it is Asia. You're not actually buying an underlying market. You're not buying the Chinese market. You're buying into Tencent and Alibaba, which are, speculative Chinese tech stocks, mm-hmm. which might be fine for your portfolio, but they're being misrepresented as being a way to access the rest of the world that's non-US.
Right.
And there's also changes in the way. So the MSCI back in 2000 to 2010, it was the BRIC countries. And as I said, they converted the index. It's Asian tech stocks. They added South Korea. They added Taiwan. So you can't even compare ETF returns from this decade, from the previous decade, because they have a totally different composition.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's one area where there have been a lot more different types of ETFs. Like the iShares, to just bring in one example, has access to just about every major economy in the world. And you can buy if it's not them, then somebody else. You can buy the, not just Chinese, you can buy the Chinese tech stocks. You can buy Chinese mm-hmm. small caps.
Right.
And then you can buy the Japan index or something that tracks the index or says it does. Same with Taiwan, same with, again, you name a country and chances are there's an ETF for it. But so are those things also equally divisive, or I should say, that is the advertising equally confusing there?
Well, I think most people don't actually, they're not, at least within the U.S., most people aren't invested in individual markets. They are just invested in IEMG, emerging market funds. And as I said, they're tracking the MSCI, and the MSCI is 70% Asian tech. Mm. Now, I've covered, you know, India, China, and I advocate if you are going to go for international, you need to understand which countries are you going to. Because if you just say developed markets, Japan is very different from Australia, it's very different from Germany. And so that's why I advocate, you know, what I do is look at it a country by country approach and say what countries actually do I think will do well.
Yeah, but then that's the research that obviously that needs to be done. Okay, so on the matter of stocks, now, what do you make of we've talked about the bond ETFs, and I mentioned the commodities, which, you know, I don't want to talk about commodities anymore because I think we've all seen that. But, and the bonds, we've made the point, but when it comes to stock ETFs, how efficient are they? Because it's not just the different sectors of the market you can get access to. You can get mm-hmm. access to different investing styles. You have your value ETFs, you have your growth ETFs. How effective are those? Do you like those at all, or is it the same or different problems there?
I just put out an article, Strategic Stock Investing, where I went through actually the performance of those year to date. So even if you, first off, going value versus growth, I think value is much too broad a term, and it obscures being able to understand what's going on in value companies. So growth companies are growing. Value companies aren't growing. Okay, does that mean they're a value, or does that just mean they're cheap? So it's really growth and non-growth, aka cheap stocks. And so first off, I don't know why you'd want to buy a basket of cheap stocks. You'd want to pick through it. So for instance, I bought Kraft with changing of this guard with coronavirus, it had over a 6% dividend yield. And so, okay, let's pick that. That was in the value camp. But if you actually bought the value index, you'd be worse off than if you bought the growth. But even within growth, I mean, there are problems with ETFs to begin with, especially with a taxable account. It's better to have individual positions because then you can take your losers to offset your winners to lower your capital gain. But you also, even let's say an ETF, you know, there are obvious losers. I mean, we've seen the offline retailers as far as Macy's and JCPenney. Why do you want to invest in those? So that's why I advocate for my clients, let's buy individual stocks. We're going to get 20 to 50 of them, and we're going to try to pick the winners instead of getting, you know, as I said, this cheap black hole of everything. Mm-hmm. When we can add logic and analysis to try to identify the top few that we think will outperform. And I think you can see in my analysis, there are at least 20 stocks, much more that you could actually have made money this year, which I did once I converted for my clients out of the companies that were going to lose in this environment into companies that were going to win. So I think ETFs, if you have, you know, a few thousand dollars and not much time, then that's basically one of the only things you can do. But if you have a lot more money and time and can, you know, find a professional like me or you do all the homework on yourself, then it makes sense to try to be more strategic around creating a strategic portfolio, not just a bunch of black holes.
Hmm. Yeah, if you're doing all this research, certainly the point could be made that you may as well go all the way and just take it a bit further and buy the vanilla stocks. And the interesting thing here also is the timing of this and the way that markets have evolved. As you mentioned at the outset, back when ETFs were invented, it was a way to get access to a broad number of stocks at a cheap price. And that was back when commissions, you know, brokers were charging like a nickel a share or something like that, right? And now, guess what? Commissions are basically free.
Right.
So you're not paying anything there. I mean, so, you know, you have to monitor it, obviously, for tax purposes and other things like that. But the transaction cost itself is, it's not there anymore. So
And the fact that you can buy one share of stock. So you can buy one share of Amazon for $2,000. You don't have to pay for 100 shares.
Actually, you can even buy fractions of a share of stock.
Now. Exactly. So that means that that we can construct a diversified portfolio of stocks for you that was not as possible back in before ETFs were created.
Very interesting. Okay, Maya Jolson, I want to come back and discuss some of this some more, and also get into your background a little bit, because you don't just talk about stocks and bonds and ETFs, but you have actually a pretty diverse background and also have some views on economics and things like that. So I want to come back and quiz you on all that, but let's first take a short break.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We are on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and other platforms where podcasts are found. Subscribe and supply an honest rating. We are on social media. Search for Contrarian Investor Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on LinkedIn as well. Go to linkedin.com/contrarianpodcast. We want to hear from our listeners. Email your thoughts to feedback@contrarianpod.com. A repository of all podcast episodes and materials is available on our website, contrarianpod.com. Now, back to the program. Here's Mr. Baker.
We're back. Welcome back, Maya Jolson. This is the point of the podcast where our guest introduces themselves a little bit more and talks a little bit about their background and how they came to this point of their careers. And I'm sure all our listeners are curious to hear this. So why don't you take it away and fill us in on that, please?
I guess one overarching theme in my life is around international economics and business and politics. I guess it started from my father grew up in France in World War II. He's Jewish, and so he escaped. My grandfather had grown up in Latvia, was studying at Moscow State University, getting his PhD in engineering in 1917 when they said he had to teach communism. So he decided to leave, and that's when he went to France and met my grandmother from Austria, and luckily saw the tea leaves and got out of France and back to the U.S. And so my dad went on to Harvard Law and international law. And my mother went to Georgetown School of Foreign Affairs, so always international was a big theme in my family. And so college, I had chose a program based after Oxford to read the great books, Wesleyan, so The Wealth of Nations themselves. And it was the early 90s, and I said, where's more interesting than Russia, which was undergoing this huge transformation from communism to capitalism, authoritarianism to democracy. So I went to Russia in the early 90s and got 18 wandering around there. And when I graduated college, I decided it was too cold and corrupt. And meanwhile, I'd been studying about the Industrial Revolution, and here I saw the first glimpses of this digital revolution. You know, I was playing with Mosaic and the browser, and I said, technology is the next thing. So I got a job with DARPA, well, it's now Lockheed Martin Advanced Technology Labs. And what we did is worked with the CIA and FBI and how are we going to build technologies for this new future. So if you remember 9/11, the problem was CIA was not talking to FBI, which was not talking about security. So I would think about what would that future be. So I really enjoyed that. Always, that's kind of one interest too, is looking at what's going to happen in the future and how are we going to prepare for it. And so later got my MBA at Kellogg. It was the dot-com crash. And so I went back to the international, went to Harvard, did more international economics. I also wrote the first paper for the World Economic Forum on women in business. Back then they had nothing on it because they couldn't see why women were important. And I was like, well, we're 50% of the labor force and we make a lot of purchasing decisions from 50 to 80% of the household. So that helped launch the gender program. But I was always interested in the markets. I was a good writer. So I went to Wall Street. I became an equity analyst at Credit Suisse and Citigroup, covering consumer, retail, doing all the numbers, financial analysis. But I found it very confining, just sticking with a few number of stocks. And you often had, there were often not reasons other than your true belief for why you had to have a rating on a stock. And so I wanted something broader. So I went to London and I worked for Emerging Markets Bank, as I said, advising Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan on investments in Russia and Africa. So that was really interesting. I wrote a lot. I got great feedback from the head of emerging markets to then everyone, you know, all the analysts at Goldman Sachs. But the 2008 crash, so I went to Rio Tinto, which is a big mining firm. And they had seen their own reckoning in 2008 when they had bought a very big mining firm, aluminum in Canada, and they couldn't pay their debts and almost got subsumed by the biggest mining firm. So I was brought on to help them with scenario planning, not just what's the macroeconomic prospects, but what could go wrong? What's the scenario planning? And so I loved that and really enjoyed that. And that was the growth of China and India. And so that's why I bring a lot of that to my work. With the commodity boom coming out, I decided to go into wealth management. I started at Merrill Lynch in DC, but wanted to have my own, be able to write my own ideas. And so founded MetaPoint Advisors. And also, you know, I was restricted with respect to what stocks I could buy. I often disagreed, like, for instance, they were bullish in oil and I was not. So I had much more purview to build portfolios for my clients based on what I thought was going to be the best way to go. And so I have a very international background, but that being said, I think the US is the strongest economy since 2014, 2015. So I've had most of my equity portfolios within the US, and I, you know, have an overweight towards a lot of technology stocks, given that's the engine of, given the engine and given my background in AI and technology and, you know, mining and oil, that's partially how I can cover a lot of the stocks. In order to do stock picking around a whole portfolio, because I worked across these industries and geographies. Hmm.
Very interesting, yeah. And you mentioned some of your research. You had a piece back in February, if memory serves, called Better Be Safe Than SARSY, SARS-Y, which basically told your readers to de-risk their portfolios, and which at the time turned out to be a very wise decision. Where do you view things now in light of that, in light of everything that's going on with the coronavirus and all of that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote before a piece saying that I thought the coronavirus was a black swan, and really right. No one had talked about that. And the market was at a peak in February. And so that's why I started selling off my clients at that peak, because the market, if you look at it, there's been a 10-year bull market from 2010 to 2020, uninterrupted. It was fueled, you know, first was recovery, then Trump came into office, and whether you like him or not, he was considered business friendly, and that created a fuel as far as less regulation, fewer costs. Okay, so stocks would go up, U.S. stocks would go up again. Then we had the corporate tax rate, which also increased earnings for U.S. stocks, as well as share buybacks. And so I started to get conservative last year because the share buybacks were waning. And also, you know, Nancy Pelosi, the Democrats had controlled the House. So there was going to be much less that was going to be able to be passed. And meanwhile, an election. So I didn't see many positive catalysts yet at a 10-year bull market. So that's why I'd already started to get conservative and worried, saying, let's take some profits off the table. And when the coronavirus came through, I think still people are kept underestimating it. I mean, when I wrote it, you know, it's already hit the second biggest economy, which is China. This is going to have a big impact. Goldman Sachs was saying, oh, it's like Ebola, it won't have an impact. You know, I think now the world's come around, but they're still putting a positive spin, hoping it'll be a, quote, V-shaped recovery and everything will be back as normal. So we're down, I think, when we were down 30%, it's bounced up. We're about down 15%, which is not very much given the size of what a lot of pundits are calling depression. I mean, we're at 25 million joblessness. So I think there is, you know, very good possibility that there could be another leg down. And that's why also I wrote that paper, Better Late Than Better.
Safe.
Better. What was
it? Safe than sorry.
Is because I feel a lot of the news out there, they all try to put the positive spin and they don't, you know, you might not disagree, but let's just look at the numbers. So for instance, if you look at what a lot of these analysts are putting out, they'll say, if you had not been invested since March 2009, you would have missed this much of the market. And I'd say, yes, but what if you had gotten out of the market and you missed the peak to trough decline. So the peak to trough decline in 2001 was 50%. The peak to trough decline was also 50% or more, average of 53%. And for each of them, it took 5.5 to 7 years, so let's say average 6 years to get back to where the peak was. So my view is, why ride this elevator down if, you know, you can try to protect some gains. And so what I did, protect gains, and actually what I did is a lot of clients wanted to stay invested, and I just converted them into stocks that would do well in this environment, and now I'm up on the year. And that's up on the year, including, let's say, keeping stocks, let's say an Apple, I consider a core holding. So let's say, you know, bought at 100, it's definitely over that. If you were to sell it, capital gains are 20%. So you have to think, you know, it might not be worth it to sell it, take the 20% gain, if it's, we're just going to buy it back within a year.
Right.
So up on the year. So my view is to buy individual stocks, or to, you know, find someone who can, but a diversified stocks that's going to do well in this environment. And the good news is that there are companies like in consumer staples, in healthcare, that have been neglected for many years and are now it represent much better opportunities.
This, of course, begs the question, which companies?
Well, I can't give you all of them.
Well, okay, but a couple.
But I said, like, value Kraft, right? Okay. So Kraft, well, so obviously everyone knows Amazon. One I like is Chewy. Do you know Chewy?
Yeah, the animal, the pets, yeah.
So who wants to stand in line for, you know, 10, all this time to get their dog or cat food when you can just sign up to the service and get it all delivered? And then certainly, you know, there's, we're talking on Zoom. It's now a verb.
Yeah.
I mean, it's up maybe 50%, but the market's up. I mean, usage is up times 20 at least. So, but I mean, what I try to do is get a portfolio across industries and sectors, mm-hmm. and not to bet too much on one company making it. And then the good news is some companies are up, can be up to 20%, but some might fall 50%, and then you can use those as the losses.
Mm-hmm.
The good thing is you can go up 20%, but you can go up 200%, but you can't fall more than 100%.
That's true. Yes. Now, some of the, unless you hold an oil ETF or oil futures, then as we can
but I've
see,
been out of oil since 2014.
right. As we've seen, those do indeed go negative, surprisingly. But some of these companies you mentioned, though, these tech. Some of them are tech companies, and some of them are recent entrants to the stock market. They just recently had an IPO. And even a company like Kraft, I think, has quite a bit of debt on their balance sheet, don't they, from acquisitions and such?
Right. So, it's not a concern. I mean, I just took a bet. That's why that's one of those value companies that I say, though, you know, you take a bet on, you know, that mm-hmm. I think that the brand, I mean, I know my nieces, when they sit at home, they always have Kraft macaroni and cheese. And okay. We're having a lot more people sitting at home. You know, everyone likes Heinz ketchup, you know. So I'm making a bet that their assets will hold them through. Mm-hmm. And given this, you know, they're weighed down before by nobody went to the center of the aisle. And now people are, right? People are stocking up in the center of the aisle. Mm-hmm. So that can help alleviate some of those pressures that they had before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Interesting. Okay. So, but as far as the big picture is the economy, it seems to be you're not an adherent of the V-shape theory very much, which I found very few people are. And I think that also holds with historical precedent. As I mentioned to some other guests, I would challenge anybody to name an actual V-shaped recovery from history. Can you think of any? I can't.
Well, I think that why this was a V-shape is just how aggressive the Federal Reserve has been.
Yeah.
And almost too aggressive. I kind of agree with Mohammed Al-Aryan that, mm-hmm. you know, we have a worry of keeping up these zombie companies that maybe should have gone under. You know, I covered Europe as well. Europe has not recovered as well from the 2008 crisis, and partly because they wouldn't let any of their big companies fail, that they propped them up, and now they're still not really on their own two feet, whereas you see now our banks are in much better position, and mm-hmm. I think that's part of the reason that the U.S. economy outperformed the European economy, because, you know, at some point, if a company can't stand on its own two legs, it shouldn't necessarily be mm-hmm. propped up.
Yeah. Especially if some companies have histories of bankruptcies, which, as we know, certain airlines, in fact, I think just about all airlines do. Okay.
Yeah, cool. So why can't they go bankrupt again, right?
Exactly. Right.
I mean, so why should the taxpayer be on the hook instead of the bondholders who they made a calculated risk, right?
And they're equity holders. The junior part of the thing, and they're still holding on. They're still going to be redeemed here, supposedly. So, okay, cool. All right, Maya Jolson, thank you so much for joining us. In closing, maybe tell our listeners, and I will put this in the show notes as well, the links to the various pieces of research that we've mentioned. You are not active on the social media.
I'm working on it.
Okay, yes, it is a job. I tell you this as somebody who, as we all know, posts pretty frequently on the Twitter. But other places that people can find you?
Well, so I have a website, www.metapointadvisors, and that has all my, a lot of the research I've done throughout my career, that anything that I can make public around these range of topics, and my at metapointadvisors.com. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm working, maybe you'll see me on Twitter very soon.
I hope so.
More active.
Yes. You can pass off some barbs with the rest of us on Twitter and smart alecky responses as
well. I'd love to.
Do. But the MetaPoint Advisors, just to clarify, is advisors with an O. Okay, cool. I think that's a good place to wrap it up.
Great. Right, thank you very much. Nice
thank
to
you.
Be
and
here.
We look forward to speaking to everybody again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate. But you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.